health issues to vocational training to childcare and housing placement. Chapman Partnership guides the homeless from hopelessness to self-sufficiency, having served over 90,000 people with a success rate upwards of 62%. You can help the homeless with your support for Chapman Partnership. Details at 877-548-6369 or chapmanpartnership.org.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you on this Wednesday, along with Bonnie Berman. Hello, Bonnie.
Hello.
Well, we have one of our friends with us, and we'll explore the roots of the American Revolution with author Les Standiford. His latest book is Desperate Sons, Samuel Adams, Patrick Henry, John Hancock, and the Secret Bands of Radicals Who Led the Colonies to War. Always good to see you, Les.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
So the American Revolution didn't come from the lofty goals of philosophers necessarily, but from merchants and the proletariat?
People still debate that, particularly in academic circles, but I think that this was pretty much a grassroots movement.
So much has been written about the American Revolution. What piqued your interest, and why did you write this book about the Sons of Liberty?
Well, you know, we from this end of history's telescope, we take the revolution for granted. Oh, yes, that happened, and it was a matter of course, and we've got some heroic stories to tell about how it began. But I ran across an article a few years ago, just at the beginning of the current academic or the economic woes, and talking about the bursting of the first housing bubble in the country, and it happened before there even was a country. Benjamin Franklin had come home from being an envoy to London in 1762 to find, to be shocked at what he was going to have to pay for rent, how rents had trebled and more than that in the 5 years he'd been gone, because the British government had been quartering all their troops, and particularly their officers who were engaged in the conduct of the French, what we call the French and Indian War between 1755 and 62, any place they could. They were willing to pay any amount for a house they would, or a farm. When the war was finally, with the French and the Indians, was finally concluded and the troops were sent back home, all of a sudden land values plummeted. Nobody wanted those houses anymore. Mortgages were going unpaid, farms were being seized, the economy went into a tailspin. People who had thought the party would never end suddenly discovered that the party had in fact ended, and it was a lot like what we were facing in 2008. And that led me to a new appreciation of the economic circumstances that underlay the onset of difficulties with Great Britain. Something that I had never thought about. As I said before, oh yes, there had been a revolution. It happened in 1775 and came up from nowhere, and Paul Revere and others took care of it. The more I began to read about those early years, 1765 and the English, the Stamp Act imposed on the colonies by Parliament, the more intrigued I became, and I realized that this was a very daring, desperate operation undertaken by a few lonely souls in the early days, and who were in large part decried, if not despised, by most of their fellow colonists as crazy people.
It's interesting that you mentioned Benjamin Franklin, because he was actually a late comer to the revolution, and in your book you describe about angry colonists actually threatened to burn down his home.
It got his attention that it was felt that he was somewhat out of touch and too close a friend to the British parliamentarians and ministers whom he was lobbying on behalf of interests in the colonies. And Franklin himself, having spent all that time in Europe, was a little bit out of touch with the mood of the colonies. And it took him a while to reacquaint himself with the complaints that colonists had. As I point out, it's probably more accurate to call Albany, New York, the cradle of liberty than Philadelphia, because Philadelphia and Franklin, as you say, did come late to this party.
And the Dutch influence in Albany, explain that.
Well, Albany was, as New York, as Manhattan was, founded largely by Dutch settlers. And in Albany, most of them involved in the fur trade. And the fur trade was curtailed on the Western frontier. That's what the Western frontier was in those days, because of the troubles, the war with the Indians and the French. So people didn't want to be out there trapping when bullets were flying over their heads. And a guy named Van Schaack decided that to make ends, who lived in Albany, decided to make ends meet. He would take the job, the newly created job, of collecting taxes for the Stamp Act in 1765, only to have it made clear to him by a number of his fellow citizens that if he took that job, dire consequences would follow. He was a stubborn sort, so they burned his house down to show him that they meant exactly what they said. And that so-called, those disturbances or riots in Albany in early 1766 really are the first demonstrable demonstrations, troubles that led eventually over the next 10 years to an outbreak of war between the colonists and Great Britain.
Can you describe for us the oppressive living conditions imposed upon the American citizens by the British?
Well, it wasn't the living conditions themselves so much as it was the attempts by the British to recoup some of the expenses that they had incurred in the waging of that war over the 7 or 8 years that it was fought. The view in Parliament, the view of King George, was that they had expended great sums of money to make the colonies a safe place to live, to chase the Indians away from the frontier, to allow gradual westward movement on the and settlement by the colonists, and to ensure that colonists wouldn't become French citizens. And when times were began to become tough in Great Britain, the operative notion was, well, the colonies got us into this mess. The colonies should be willing to help pay our way out of it. But as I've already said, the economy of the colonies was in as bad a shape as was that in England, and there was a great deal of resentment. The Stamp Act had nothing to do with stamps on letters. It was the stamp on a document that proved that the tax had been paid, and this tax was levied on every legal document, deed, will, business agreement, newspaper, copy of magazines, even a deck of playing cards and a pair of dice were subject to this tax. And each document had to bear the stamp of the official who collected the tax. That's where the name comes from.
What kind of tax was that? I mean, how much in turn, can you give us a monetary amount or a percentage?
Well, it varied depending on what it was. A tax to distill liquor was significant. Might be $11 or $12 to pay for your yearly license make wine or distill liquor. $11 or $12 may not sound much now, but this is at a time when a laborer might earn a dollar or two a week. So an $11 tax, even if you weren't a day laborer, was still a significant outlay of money. One of the things about doing this kind of research is the difficulty of giving people an idea of how much people made. But a school teacher might earn $40 to $60 a year in those times. And at that time, a wig might cost $5. So somebody, a school teacher, wouldn't wear a wig. Only a nobleman would wear a wig. Somebody that made big money. You wouldn't spend five of your $40, your yearly subsistence wages, on a wig.
Touch on the significance of Charles Townshend, and he was the one who labeled Americans as children.
Well, he this is a guy who became known as Champagne Charlie Townshend. He's the author of the hated Townshend Acts that were additional ways to raise revenue on the colonies. And they were debating his newly proposed issues in Parliament. The debate got late. They had to break for dinner. Townshend and some of his buddies enjoyed a bottle of champagne, then went back and he stood and delivered an impassioned oration in, on behalf of these measures. And it was subsequently passed without opposition. And people said it was the bubbly that so inspired him to be so profound when he spoke. And he earned that nickname, Champagne Charlie. These were hated. It was just more of the same in the eyes of the colonists. Why can't they understand that we don't have the money to pay taxes? And furthermore, why don't they understand how onerous it seems when we have no say in the matter? These were taxes imposed upon the colonies, and there never had been taxes before. There were a couple of import duties previously on molasses and sugar. These were the first taxes actually levied on the colonists by the crown. And the real complaint was that colonists had no voice in Parliament when these measures were being debated. So the rallying cry was no taxation, no more taxation without representation.
And who actually said that?
It's debated. It pops up three or four times. It's a complicated argument that this is where I have to say, I don't know.
Maybe okay.
Read the book.
All right. All right. We're speaking with educator and author Les Standiford. His latest book is Desperate Sons. We're on today's Topical Currents Wednesday edition. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station. NPR for the Florida Keys is 91.5 WKWM, and we're also streaming online at WLRN.org. We're funded by listeners like you and by Willie the Bee Man. Proper bee removal requires two steps, locating the hive and extracting the honeycomb. Willie the Bee Man offers complete beehive removal. Details at GetRidOfBees.com or 1-800-9- No bees.
A Salute to Vienna returns to the Adrian Arts Center Sunday, December 30th at 7 p.m. Hungarian maestro Andras Dejek debuts with the Strauss Symphony Orchestra of America and a brand new program. The new cast of European singers and dancers celebrate and inspire with Strauss waltzes, polkas, and operetta. A Salute to Vienna, Sunday, December 30th at 7 p.m. Information at artscenter.org.
We'd like to thank our corporate underwriters, the St. Thomas University, Florida Power and Light, and Belen Jesuit Preparatory School. These corporate underwriters help bring you the programs you enjoy throughout the year. Please join WLRN in thanking them for their continued support.
Like Topical Currents Facebook page at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Join the conversation, post a comment, share links, and see what other listeners are saying at facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, with author Les Standiford. We're talking about his book, Desperate Sons, Samuel Adams, Patrick Henry, John Hancock, and the secret bands of radicals who led the colonies to war. If you'd like to join in the conversation, that's easy enough. Our number, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, email. That's radio@WLRN.org. Les Standiford, we always talk about George Washington being the father of our country, but in your book you propose it's actually Samuel Adams as the real father.
Some say that. Of course, Washington is known so much for his activities during the fighting of the Revolution and then, of course, in the formation of the government following the cessation of the hostilities, but the truth is, if it hadn't been for Samuel Adams, there might never have been a revolution. It's something that academicians debate, that, we would have probably broken away from Great Britain eventually, but it might have happened in the way of Canada, and that we might still have our ties to Great Britain. The fact is, though, that it happened the way it did, with the firing of the shot, beginning with the firing of the shot heard around the world in Concord, and then Lexington on that fateful day. And it was Samuel Adams who was the great communicator. of among the groups, groups of men organized simultaneously and at first without any communication, called Sons of Liberty in the various colonies, in New York City, in Albany, in New Hampshire, in Boston, as far away as South Carolina. When they discovered the formulation of these groups, each was greatly surprised. But the man who became the coordinator, the great communicator, if you will, between the groups, the disparate Sons of Liberty chapters in the various colonies, was Sam Adams. And one of his neighbors used to walk by the house as late as 2 a.m. and see the light on in Adams' study, and he claimed to be able to hear the scribbling of his pen in that upstairs room, whispering, "Liberty, liberty, liberty."
His relation to John Adams.
This is his cousin, John Adams. And actually, on opposite sides of the divide in the early days, in the wake of the Boston Massacre, John Adams actually defended the British troops who fired upon the citizens of Boston, who had been protesting in the streets one night. And Samuel Adams never faulted his cousin for doing what he thought was right, because he himself felt that if your actions were done in defense of a moral, defensible reason, that then they were valid.
Those British soldiers were harassed tremendously and reacted.
And that was John Adams' view, that had any colonist been in their shoes, they would have probably done the same. They fired to defend themselves.
Describe the Sons of Liberty, what they were up against, their bravery and their valor.
Well, they were involved in activities that, had they been caught, would have been tried and hanged. They would have faced charges of treason, which was a capital offense in those days. One of the great fears, one of the legislations that the pieces of legislation that angered the colonists was the possibility of being removed to Great Britain for trial for some of these actions, and it was seen that would be a sure death sentence. If you were tried in Great Britain on charges of treason, the game would be up. At first, the sons tried polite protest, but things from the beginning, as in the case of Henry Van Schack's insistence upon taking that Stamp Act position, one thing led to another, and before you know it, his house was in flames, because that's just how inflamed the populace was. The passions ran high, and the desperate, the Sons of Liberty were the first groups willing to go beyond polite redress and petition, which is what men like Benjamin Franklin had been trying for several years in London, to better the lot of the colonists. And by this time, enough, it was felt, was enough.
So what other acts of violence did they have to resort to?
Well, the protests in New York led to the burning of the governor's house and the storming of governmental offices, the sacking of offices. Then ultimately, the most famous confrontations, first the Boston Massacre, then finally the Boston Tea Party, where bullets were flying, and then ultimately the first a confrontation between troops came at in Concord, in Lexington, there in 1775. That was the first actual literal combat, although people had been killed before in sporadic incidents.
So how were they able to finally rally the public? I mean, they were these disparate groups and calling themselves the Sons of Liberty. How were they able to get the public behind them eventually?
Well, finally through the media. The left-leaning
Thomas
media.
Thomas Paine.
Yes. Well, the pamphlets became important, magazines of that sort. But the rise of the Sons of Liberty is concurrent with the creation of the newspaper media, the newspaper business in the United States. Before that time, newspapers were essentially advertising circulars. They would tell you what ships had docked and at the local port in the past week and what they were carrying. They would advertise homes for sale, slaves for sale, that sort of thing. But there wasn't much news as we think of it today printed in those papers. And when letter writers began to describe what had happened in Charleston, South Carolina, or what had happened at some disturbance in Albany or in Boston, why the sales of these newspapers skyrocketed, and editors suddenly realized, hey, we're onto something here. And those editors who were more liberal and more sympathetic to the cause of the rebels played this up as much as they
could. Would
that be
Peter Zenger involved in that?
Well, that case was several years before the, but it laid the legal groundwork to protect, to give the editors of the papers the sense that they were exempt from charges if they published material that was offensive to the crown, to the established government.
Therefore, not subject to libel because of truth.
That's right.
So how were they able to avoid being apprehended?
That was in the 1730s, yeah.
How were they able to avoid being apprehended by the Americans or the British?
Well, one way they wrote anonymously. And that's one reason why the men who boarded the British ships and dumped tea in Boston Harbor were disguised as Indians. Because they didn't want to be known for who they were, and demonstrated anonymously up until the outbreak of until the declaration of war in 1775, and that protected them. Everyone believed they knew who Samuel Adams was, but Samuel Adams hadn't identified himself publicly.
I see.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, also email, that's radio@wlrn.org. Bonnie, you have an email?
No, not yet, but it's
ready. I have one here. Someone wants to know, are today's desperate Sons of Liberty the Tea Partiers?
Yeah.
You have modern-day groups calling themselves Tea Partiers and modern-day contemporary groups of Sons of Liberty of Tennessee and so forth. And one big difference is that the original Sons of Liberty and Tea Partiers were really fighting to form a government, and as much as tear one apart, the government that prevailed at the time, they had no part in. There was no voice. Today's Tea Partiers and Sons of Liberty have a government. They're just not very happy with it sometimes. Sam Adams was approached in 1792, one of my favorite stories in the book, after the government, of course, had been in operation for quite some time, and a tax had been levied on corn used to make liquor. And in western Pennsylvania, the farmers didn't want to pay that tax to the federal government, the U.S. federal government. And a reporter came to Sam. They were chasing revenuers off their properties, with rifles and shotguns firing at them. And somebody went to Sam Adams and said, I bet that you're in support of these rebels out there in western Pennsylvania doing these things. And Adams frumped and said, certainly not. It was just and necessary to take up arms when we were subject to the whim of a king and a parliament and a system in which we had no voice. But once a republic had been formed, anyone who takes up arms against it ought, in my opinion, to be hanged.
Did some of the fervor for the American Revolution really spring from the bar rooms and brothels of the colonies?
I don't think so. The prime movers of the original Sons of Liberty movement were merchants, men like John Hancock, who were traders, who owned ships, who had been involved in trading, and whose livelihood stood to lose the most because of these taxes.
So most of the Sons of Liberty were wealthy?
No, they weren't wealthy. They were middle class. You would say the leaders of the middle class. Most of the people who rallied to the cause were those who worked for merchants, who knew they if John Hancock went out of business, they wouldn't have a job.
We're speaking with Les Standiford on today's Topical Currents. He's an author and educator, and his latest book is Desperate Sons. And we're going to take another short break. We'll be right back.
And you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. Florida Keys Green Living and Education presents community meetings about climate change and its possible impacts on the Florida Keys. All meetings are open to the public. More information at keysglee.com. That's a notice from the WLRN Community Bulletin Board.
The University of Miami is still accepting applications for the January start of its MBA for Working Professionals and Executive MBA programs. With evening and weekend classes, these programs enable you to earn the UM MBA without interrupting your career. Both include an international study option and a variety of elective options so you can design your program to best meet your own career goals. Now is the time to apply for classes that begin in January. More about the streamlined application process at miamimba.com. That's miamimba.com. Back by popular demand, The Sandaland Diaries, the gleeful Christmas rant by David Sedaris, master American satirist, features audience favorite Michael McKeever in this hilarious, critically acclaimed holiday hit. Opening in Boca Raton's Meisner Park on December 13th. Tickets at 866-811-4111. That's 866-811-4111 or paradeproductions.org. The Sandaland Diaries, a delightfully twisted grown-up holiday treat.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper. We're visiting with Les Standiford. He's an author and educator, and his latest book is Desperate Sons, Samuel Adams, Patrick Henry, John Hancock, and the Secret Bands of Radicals Who Led the Colonies to War. We're going to take some calls shortly. If you'd like to join in the conversation, the number to call is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, or you can email radio@wlrn.org.
And first caller, we have Emma. She's in Miami. Hello, Emma. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about the role of slaves during the American Revolutionary War. I've been reading, and my son's been reading, a young adult novel by M.T. Anderson called Octavian Nothing, and then the sequel to that. And it's about a slave who basically runs away and joins the British Army to help them against the American revolutionaries. And also, I believe there's some inherent hypocrisy in, you know, in the white man wanting the freedom from the British but not allowing his slaves to be freed as well. So I was wondering if you could elaborate on the role of slaves during that time, please.
Well, there was a division of opinion even at this time in the colonies. The great plantations of the South depended upon slave labor for the maintenance of their operations. But in the Northeast, the sentiment was already pretty hard and fast against slavery. And it depended on where you were economically and geographically in the colonies, what your feelings were about slavery. But the movement toward emancipation had already begun. Obviously, it didn't culminate for another 100 years or so. But the issue, and I haven't read the books that you refer to. But yes, indeed, there were disparate feelings even among indentured servants and slaves who felt that to end the system as they knew it. Well, who knew what would happen? At least those slaves and those indentured servants could count on, you know, three squares and decent treatment and so forth. And a number of them wanted no part of these upstart activities.
But many also did participate in the Continental Army.
They did indeed.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, we think about Massachusetts Governor John Hancock and his significance as the largest signature on the Declaration of Independence, but what was his role behind the scenes?
And you probably think of him as an insurance company,
right,
too. But he was just like Sam Adams. We know him today mostly as a face on a beer. But we're not even sure that he was ever, or any member of his family, was involved in brewing. It makes for a nice legend, of course, and nice spokesperson. But we don't know about that. Hancock was a trader. He owned several ships that went plied.
Trader with a D.
Yes, trader.
Trader.
Yes. And sent his ships to England to sell American goods and brought back British manufacturers for people to enjoy. There was no manufacturing in the colonies at the time, none whatsoever. We grew tobacco. We made some calico cloth. We grew cotton, but we didn't make anything. There were individual silversmiths like Paul Revere, but there was no china manufacturing. So we were dependent on any fineries from Great Britain, and that was another fear of people. They said, geez, we're going to be cut off with nothing. Everything will have to be smuggled from Holland or France. A great deal of uncertainty at first. And Hancock was seen by some as an opportunist, interested only in furthering his own interests and beating the British out of taxes that he probably should contribute to the cause. It depended on where you sat. These men were seen by one man's activist is another man's traitor or terrorist, as they were branded at the time. But Hancock found a great deal of support on the streets and on the docks among working men who came to understand that unless there was a working economy, a functioning economy in the colonies, the result was going to be a terrible divide between the haves and the have-nots. The only people in the colonies who had any money were British subjects who'd come over here and were the recipient of a kind of spoils system, huge land grants, well-paying jobs for which they weren't particularly, most times weren't particularly qualified. Great deal of resentment around them, because the only money that was made in the colonies was the result of hard work, and it was dangerous work plying ships across the Atlantic. It's not like today where you put cargo containers on a big ship and count your money. And it was a pretty harrowing existence.
What was the role of the Sons of Liberty after the Revolution? Did they have a role?
Well, they did. These were the people that Washington was a son, a member of a chapter in Virginia, was inspired by Patrick Henry, as was Thomas Jefferson. Just that they weren't as politically active as some. Now, obviously, Washington we came to know because of his role in once the bullets started to fly. But they were involved and in sympathy. But nobody thought until the 11th hour that there was going to be armed conflict. Everyone, Washington and Sam Adams, I believe, too, believed that the British were going to sit down at the table and finally see the error of their ways and negotiate a resolution to this impasse.
Who was the British, the strongest proponent of pursuing the Revolutionary War on the British side?
Well,
was it the King George?
Ultimately, the colonists at first proclaimed themselves eternally loyal to the king. They blamed Parliament for all their ills. Finally, it became clear, however, that Parliament took its marching orders from the top, and that when push came to shove, King George essentially was calling the shots in Parliament. And this further enraged a lot of the sons who, up until that time, had seen themselves almost as sons of the king. They saw themselves in that role, and that surely a wise father would, when it came right down to it, understand, would divvy up the spoils between his colonial progeny and the British.
And the role of General Gage, didn't he have a pacifist side to begin with?
It was the rare Briton who wanted to go back into war. The country was exhausted, its resources spent because of what had been expended against fighting the French and the Indians. And no one, it's like present day America, who is not weary of the war in Afghanistan, Iran? Who thinks that we could take on another armed conflict? Who wants that? There might be a few people, but the feeling was the same. We cannot afford this. This is impossible. And furthermore, they are us. They have the same last names as we do. They just happen to live across the Atlantic. The king didn't want an armed insurrection. No one saw this coming.
Mm. Let's take another telephone call. Next up, we have line five. This is Michael in Pembroke Pines. Hi.
Yes, hi. I was curious as to why the British weren't able to infiltrate the Sons of Liberty and round them all up. And number two, what was the makeup of Freemasons as far as the Sons of Liberty are concerned?
To take up the second question first, it's sometimes theorized that particularly in the Northeast that most of the more prominent Sons of Liberty were also Freemasons, that this was how they had come to know one another. This was their fraternal society where they got together and exchanged their political ideas, so forth. It's, you know, the society was secret, so it's difficult to prove, but pretty much that's the feeling. And that's led to all sorts of speculation about Freemasonry ideograms and so forth being built into the emblems of the new nation and so forth. Very difficult to prove, but fascinating speculation. Books, entire books have been written about the role of Masons in the formation of the country and the design of America.
The dollar bill.
Yes, right. And all that. It makes for a fascinating reading. But first question, why weren't, I think there was a little drop out there. You said, why weren't?
Weren't they rounded up?
Why didn't people infiltrate the organization, identify them, and round them up? Well, for one thing, everyone knew pretty much who everyone was in the colonies. There were some, obviously, there were some informers, but again, no one at the outset took these activities very seriously. And I think the principal reason, though, was that we're not the anonymous society. We weren't the anonymous society then that we are today. The roles were pretty clearly defined. You worked for the British government. You had what you had because of you were given it by the British government, or you were a colonist. And if you crossed the line, as John Adams did, everyone knew it. There wasn't much subterfuge.
We're speaking again with Les Standiford. He's an author and educator. His latest work is Desperate Sons. It's today's Topical Currents. One more short break, and we'll be right back.
This is 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM NPR for the Florida Keys. You've reached a certain age, you're viewed as a success, still you are not immune. The disease of addiction doesn't discriminate based on age or status. West Palm Beach's Hanley Center is considered a center of excellence for comprehensive addiction treatment and recovery for older adults and baby boomers. Hanley Center for Older Adult and Boomer Recovery. Details at 855-718-2233. Hanley Center Recovery for Life, 855-718-2233.
Diane Rehm, one of public radio's most popular personalities, is visiting South Florida to help benefit WLRN Public Media. Join us for Dinner with Diane Rehm, Friday evening, February 8th, at Fort Lauderdale's Marriott Harbor Beach Resort and Spa. Diane Rehm shares her experiences with some of our country's most influential citizens, and you can take part in the conversation February 8th in Fort Lauderdale. Tickets available now at WLRN.org or call 866-247-9576.
We're funded by listeners like you and by Field of Flowers, delivering holiday flowers from thoughtful people like you to grateful people throughout South Florida and the world. Orders at 800-96-FRESH or online at fieldofflowers.com. You can experience the future of the arts during Young Arts Week, January 6th through 12th. Since 1981, the nation's next generation of artists have come to Miami to learn from master teachers and to share their talents with audiences through performances, screenings, and exhibitions. More information at youngarts.org.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, and of course, author Les Standiford. We're talking about his latest book, Desperate Sins. If you'd like to join in, we have a line or two open, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, and also email, that's radio@WLRN.org. Les Standiford, I've known you many years, and of course, you really kind of made your mark on the literary world with fiction, but it seems like your last four or five books have been nonfiction. Is John Deal not part of your repertoire anymore?
Well, there might be another novel about that unfortunate, honest building contractor who keeps stepping into the path of the wrong kind of people. But I've gotten fascinated, someone with history and trying to retell history in a way that brings it alive again. Someone asked me if I missed writing thrillers, and my answer was, well, I think I'm still writing thrillers. It's just that these happen to be true.
You have Desperate Sons. You had the Adam Walsh book, Bringing Adam Home, the Charles Dickens book, and, of course, the book about the 1935 Great Hurricane in the Florida Keys.
I like to take something from history that people think they know everything about and try to show that there's more to the story. Do you remember the old Paul Harvey, The Rest of the Story?
Yeah. Good day.
Yeah. So did you enjoy researching, and was it like an adventure for you to research and write this book?
Yes, it's always hard to write a story based around almost a committee because it's a group of people who were the sons, the key sons, although Sam Adams probably the most forceful. So it took a while to weave these threads into what I hope is a coherent whole. But yeah, I enjoy the challenge of being able to put together a story that people haven't heard, even though it's drawn from history.
Now, part of your title includes Patrick Henry. We really haven't touched on him. Give me liberty or give me death. His role in the Sons of Liberty.
Well, he was the spokesman in Virginia, which was, like Pennsylvania, fairly somewhat conservative in the early days. But it was Henry who stood up at the House of Burgesses and stipulated that it simply was not right that the colonists should have no say in their own affairs. And the fact that this was, at the time, the southernmost state where there was a voice also raising a clamor against the British was very influential in it. And Henry's bravery in standing up publicly in front of men like who were at the time undecided, Jefferson, a planter, George Washington, a planter and slave owner. This was a landmark moment. It can't be overemphasized, what he did, the chance that he took, and the impact that it had on his fellow Virginians.
What do you want us to take away from Desperate Sons? I mean, what, as readers?
That the revolution was not a foregone conclusion, that it came as a result of flesh and blood individuals who were taking big chances to do this. They were not heroes at the time. They didn't become heroes until Schoolboy made them legends 150 years later. These were guys who were taking the same kind of chances that civil rights leaders and countercultural activists were in the 1950s and the 1960s, laying their lives on the line for what they believed to be right and what history has proven to be right.
What about noteworthy contributions of women in this period?
Well, women's roles in society were relatively limited. You know, that's why you go along to Betsy Ross and sewing the flag until, historians trying to find women who they were disenfranchised. They didn't have the vote, obviously. Right. They were not political figures. Sam Adams' wife, however, by all accounts, never was steadfast in the support of her husband's activities. He wasn't making any money. His neighbors had to get together and hire a tailor to outfit him so that he wouldn't embarrass them when he was their envoy to the Continental Congress. She never complained because she knew that more than anything, he was the living embodiment of the concept of liberty, and that's where the notion comes from, that he was the father to the country.
How about Abigail Adams, and wasn't she a big force behind her husband's success?
Also very supportive. It's just that she had no public role.
And we'll take another phone call. We've got Joe in Coral Springs. You're on with Les Standiford. Hi there.
Hi, I'm fascinated by this presentation. I have a question about labels. Very often conservatives and radicals blur. Didn't the radicals prior to Tom Paine's arrival on the scene regard themselves as the true conservatives? They were conserving British liberty from the Glorious Revolution, habeas corpus, and regarded the Townsend and the Stamp Act people as the radicals who were changing the course of British history?
Well, that's one thing that I found interesting about this research. That, as I think I said before, one man's activist is another man's terrorist. It depends on where you stand historically on the sides of various issues, whether you're really a radical or to call yourself in today's society a contemporary son of liberty or a Tea Partier, this is the voice of the most conservative wing of the Republican Party. Back in the original day, these were the most radical left-leaning members of the population.
But their missions are quite different.
Absolutely. But the labels are interchangeable, right, depending on where you stand and depending on your political perspective.
So conservatives of that era probably would have been loyalists then, for the status quo.
Yes, they were.
Can we talk about your teaching a little?
Of course.
So are you passionate about teaching? Do you learn from your students?
He has some quite accomplished students.
Dennis Lehane among them. Yeah, I hope you all know him, great mystery writer. You like to think that you're teaching them something, but when you come across somebody that's truly talented, you help them tell them about some mistakes not to make. You can't give them talent so much as save them some time in their development. But they keep me young. They keep me interested. And I love to talk to them about telling stories, which is something that I never got when I was in school. We talked a lot about how to make a good sentence, but not so much about how to tell a story. And I think that's the backbone of most literature, whether it's fictive or nonfiction, like these histories I've been writing.
Could you elaborate on that a little bit, about telling stories versus writing sentences?
Well, for instance, when I began to write the first of these books, Last Train to Paradise, about the Flagler building his railroad from Miami to Key West, I didn't know what I was doing, and I had this mass of material, and I set out, I think, to write the world's longest encyclopedia article. And I suddenly realized, no, it's not so much the information that's interesting about this as it is the story, and that all the information will hang off the story of a man trying to do what was deemed to be impossible at the time and then proving in the end that it was, in fact, possible. It turned from Flagler's Folly into the eighth wonder of the world.
So do you have another book in the works?
I'm working on what I'm calling Last Train to Paradise West. It's the story about William Mulholland and the building of the great aqueduct that made Los Angeles possible. It's called Water to the Angels.
As in Mulholland Drive.
Mulholland Drive, yeah.
Well, we certainly want to thank you. It's been a very interesting hour. We've been speaking with author Les Standiford. He also heads the Creative Writing Department at Florida International University. And his latest book is Desperate Sons, Samuel Adams, Patrick Henry, John Hancock and the secret bands of radicals who led the colonies to war.
And we'll have a link to that on our Facebook page.
Of course we will. Good to see you again, Liz.
Oh, thank you for having me, and happy holidays.
Same to you.
And thanks for tuning in today. Our program was produced by Richard Ive, technical direction from Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Of course, we have free audio archives and MP3 downloads on our website. That's WLRN.org. And you can follow us on the Topical Currents Facebook page for author and book links such as today's, also staff photos, discussions, and more. And tomorrow's program begins with the author of Snap, Making the Most of First Impressions, Body Language, and Charisma. A bad first impression can take 6 months to override, if ever. And today's calendar, on this day in 1906, 106 years ago, the birth of Soviet and Communist Party leader Leonid Brezhnev in the Ukraine. Preceded by Khrushchev, he was in power 22 years. Only Stalin led the Soviets longer. And on this day in 1915, 97 years ago, the birth of French singer and cultural rebel Edith Piaf, the Little Sparrow in Paris. She dated a Jewish pianist during Nazi occupation and claimed membership in the French underground. One more while we recall the imprint of Sun Records. On this day in 1955, 57 years ago, rockabilly legend Carl Perkins records Blue Suede Shoes. He wrote the lyrics on scrap paper but spelled suede as S-W-A-D-E. Our theme music created by Michael Levine. And so we leave with a thought from Carl Perkins, who died of cancer in 1998. Quote, after all those days in the cotton fields, the dreams came true on a gold record on a piece of wood. It's in my den where I can look at it every day. I wear it out just looking at it. This is Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This is 91.3 W.